from WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Conservative radio talk show host Michael Medved grew up on the left side of the tracks. He campaigned for Bobby Kennedy, got out the vote for George McGovern. But those days are long gone. Medved, like a wide swath of the nation, has made a right turn. Tonight on Point, Michael Medved and the romance of the right. But first, the day after his State of the Union speech, President Bush brought his campaign to revamp Social Security to the heartland today. Under his proposal, benefits for those 55 and up won't change. Younger workers would receive fewer government benefits, but would be able to invest in personal retirement accounts. Speaking today in Fargo, North Dakota, the president said change is needed now.
You've got fewer workers paying for more retirees who are living longer, greater benefits. And if you start kind of thinking about the math there, you begin to realize we got a problem.
After North Dakota, the president went on to Montana. Tomorrow it's Nebraska, Arkansas, and Florida. Mark Silva is White House correspondent for the Chicago Tribune and is traveling with the president. He joins me now from the press bus pulling out of Great Falls, Montana. Mark, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me.
We've got a rough line, but tell us who came out to see the president today. What's your sense of the crowds?
Well, we had several thousand people at each stop in Fargo as well as Great Falls, Montana. And these were campaign crowds. These are people who were rounded up by the Bush campaign, essentially the White House now, an organization that got very good at this through the last election campaign and still has lots of lists and the ability to turn out large numbers of people in short order.
It was
phenomenal, actually, to see several thousand people show up in mid-afternoon in Great Falls, Montana.
Yes, I can understand. Did the president offer more details today than he did in the State of the Union speech last night? Did he fill in the picture?
No, he was really embellishing or actually explaining the details of what he had spoken about at the State of the Union address, talking about who would be affected and who wouldn't, and the time for when Social Security is projected to go bankrupt under his scenarios, and not really offering any new insight at all.
Mark, we've got a rough line, but let me just ask you this. He's got five states he's going to, North Dakota, Montana, Nebraska, Arkansas, Florida. Why these five? I'm sure it's not by accident.
These are five states in which there are seven Democratic senators, three of whom will face re-election in 2006. And the Senate Democratic Caucus has pretty much lined up en masse and said they will not support the president's plan. So, and they have the power to filibuster, even though they're in the minority. So the president is targeting senators in states that actually he won. These are five states that supported him in his re-election, yet there are seven out of the 10 senators who are Democrats. And like I said, three who are up for re-election in 2006. He's hoping to bring some leverage to bear on these people facing re-election, talking about an issue which may be popular at home, but unpopular among the Democratic caucus in Washington.
And what's the calculus right now? Does he have a chance to pull enough away to break a filibuster?
Oh, the Democrats sound pretty solid. They issued a letter today, a joint letter from the caucus, expressing once again their commitment to stand as a block. And the senators who Bush was courting today didn't show much sign of progress. And from his point of view, he actually flew to Montana, or actually to North Dakota, with Senator Kent Conrad of North Dakota. Conrad was on Air Force One with the president.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got to Fargo, Conrad basically got off and said, look, I still don't buy this thing. So he's got a long way to go.
Mr. President, you're on your own. A long way to go, but he's out there campaigning. Mark Silva, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Silva, White House correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. He spoke with me, and you could hear it there, from the press bus pulling out of Great Falls, Montana. Conservative talk show host Michael Medved describes himself as a theocon. Once a true blue 60s liberal, by the 80s he had embraced Orthodox Judaism and the right wing of the Republican Party. The nation's center of political gravity has moved from blue to red, and so has Medved to bright red. The left, he says, is pursuing the no frontier, giving us a no deal, while George Bush pushes a vision that he says is winning. Tonight on Point, Michael Medved and the nation's right turn. You can join the conversation tonight. Have you, too, moved right in your politics, in your view of the world? Why? What moved you? And why is the right on a roll? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Seattle is Michael Medved, host of the daily conservative talk radio program, The Michael Medved Show, which reaches about 2 million listeners a week in 140 markets across the country. He's a longtime film critic and author of Hollywood vs. America and What Happened to the Class of 65. His new book is Right Turns, Unconventional Lessons from a Controversial Life. Michael Medved, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the provocative introduction.
Well, we'll learn, I'm sure, how you're provoked. But I've got to say, first of all, you made a right turn, but you made it long before the kind of turnout that President George W. Bush saw last fall, the poll numbers we're seeing this morning, even before Ronald Reagan's ascent to the presidency, as I read it. You were turning pretty shortly after George McGovern's campaign.
I was, and there were a couple of reasons for that. I mean, in the 1970s, it seems to me that anybody who was paying attention should have made right turns just based upon historical circumstance. And one of the circumstances that made a huge difference for me was the October War in the Middle East in October of 1973. I had already begun developing a much stronger Jewish commitment. I'd begun trying to keep the Sabbath and living a more traditionally Jewish life. And then on that one October day, and it was happened to be a Saturday because it was one of those rare days where Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year, also falls on the Sabbath, Israel was attacked on two sides by Syria and by Egypt. And in the first 48 hours of that October war in 73, they lost one-third of their air force. And it was very striking that the only thing that enabled Israel's survival, which I cared about very deeply, because I had first cousins who were over there. My parents, who had been old-time Zionist leftists, had implanted at least a very strong pro-Israel feeling for me. And the Israel survival depended ultimately upon American resupply. And what was striking was in some of my previous experience working for members of Congress of the United States, I had helped to write speeches attacking the existence and the procurement of some of the same equipment that was now being used to ensure Israel's survival. And that message is, it's one of the lessons that I think is most important that I learned over the years and that I write about, the lesson that ultimately everything worth defending in the world depends upon armed force.
Everything comes down to armed force, and right away you're going to have a whole lot of liberal listeners saying, oh my gosh, where is this guy going? But that may have been a pivotal—
Into history, into reality.
We'll hear it. That may have been a pivotal moment for you, but that clearly, that October war in the early 70s was not the pivotal moment for the entire country. Yet later on, here came Ronald Reagan and then George Bush the first and George W. Bush now in his second term. How do you read the larger turn in American politics, the kind of shifting lines of red and blue? What's going on? What's brought the right up?
Well, I think President Bush addressed it last night in his State of the Union address. I actually thought that he had a line that was almost like a promotional line for Right Turns, my book. He said, so many of my generation, after a long journey, have come home to family and faith and are determined to bring up responsible, moral children. Well, the president is exactly right. I mean, this is a point that my wife makes. She's a clinical psychologist. Nobody wants to raise children with experimental morality. Nobody wants to raise children with liberal values. Conservative values is what we all want for our kids. We don't want them to be promiscuous. We don't want them to be drug addicted.
You're saying promiscuity and drug addiction are liberal values? That's just right-wing radio talk, right?
No, it's not. What I'm saying is people embrace conservative values for their own kids. I think most people would say things like fidelity, stability, predictability, reliability, hard work. Those are conservative values.
But you're interpreting all those as in opposition to liberal values? I'm sure a lot of liberals would stand up and say, come on, those are our values too.
Well, not entirely, and that's the problem, you see. And I think that's why a lot of people have changed. Because what you find from at least a generally secular and liberal elite is the idea that, well, it's wrong to judge. Well, people judge for their own kids. And I'll give you one example. Most American parents, the overwhelming majority, would like their children to, at one point or another, enter into conventional marriages that are stable and monogamous. And yet you find people discussing a lot of moral issues who will regularly defend all kinds of sexual alternatives that they would prefer their own children avoid.
But their own children might grow up to be homosexual and in love and wanting to have a long-term relationship sanctioned by marriage.
It's absolutely true. However, I think if you ask most parents, including most gay parents would say it would be better if our children grew up into a conventional heterosexual marriage.
But that's different than saying I would turn my child out and rebuke them if they didn't follow that pattern, right?
Well, that you could say that's left-wing radio talk. No right-winger that I know of says that if my child doesn't follow a pattern, I'm going to beat him or turn him out or alienate him. I happen to believe that part of what goes wrong in American life in terms of a lot of our political discourse is stereotyping on both sides. And one of the things that surprised me, having grown up in a home where Adlai Stevenson was next to Moses, is how different the reality of conservative America, what people call red state America, really was than the way it had always been portrayed to me.
We want to get that picture. We're going to hear how you made the transition, how you see what's going on right now, in particular, how you see what's going on in radio. That's big right-wing country these days. Michael Medved, please stand by. We're talking tonight with radio talk show host, conservative Michael Medved. His new book is Right Turns, Unconventional Lessons from a Controversial Life. You can join the conversation tonight. Have you drifted right in your politics, your view of the world? Why? What moved you? Lefties, were you ever tempted? Are you tempted now? And what do you hear in Michael Medved's story, his move from secular to religious, from liberal to conservative? Is this the nation's story? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with conservative talk show host Michael Medved about the romance of the right and why America's taken a right turn. His new book is Right Turns, Unconventional Lessons from a Controversial Life. You can join the conversation tonight. Gallup poll says 86% of Americans responded positively or very positively to President Bush's State of the Union address last night. What does that say about the allure of the right? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Medved, I wish you'd take us back to kind of the seedbed of this conversation for many Americans. You were active in the Bobby Kennedy campaign. You worked for George McGovern. You found yourself at Yale Law School in the same class as Bill and Hillary Clinton, or at least they're at the same time. You got to confirm that for me.
Yes, I was in the same class as Hillary, one class ahead of Bill, because he had taken time off for the Rhodes Scholarship.
Put us back in that time, how you related to people like Bill and Hillary in those days, how you saw the world before your conversion.
I saw the world as a conventional liberal Democrat. I mean, first of all, I never wandered too far afield in the extreme left. Oh, like people like my friend David Horowitz, who really was much more associated with the hard left. Mm-hmm. I mean, about the furthest left I ever got was working for Congressman Ron Dellums in Berkeley, California, briefly. And I'm deeply grateful to Congressman Dellums, because he helped to make me a conservative, because I found the 6 weeks I spent associated with him to be eye-opening and deeply disillusioning. But to get back to your question about Bill and Hillary Clinton, Hillary in particular was a good friend of mine. And one of the things that I think conservatives get wrong is they're wrong about Senator Clinton. She is an incredibly nice person. I don't know, Tom, if you've ever met her, but she is... she is a genuinely kind and caring human being.
I haven't met her sitting around a college dorm room, not in that kind of setting. It's always been more formal.
But even in that kind of formality, I think she projects a kind of warmth and decency that a lot of conservatives don't acknowledge, and we should. I mean, she's wrong on most of the major issues of our time, in my opinion, but I still consider her to be a fine human being. And someone who is obviously deeply committed to her ideals.
Talk
and
about
that
warmth.
Ought to be acknowledged.
Bill Clinton was sort of the fount of warmth, conveying warmth.
See, I never found that. I remember I describe in my book when Hillary told me for the first time, and she was a friend of mine, I mean a good friend, and she told me for the first time she was moving in with Bill, and I was horrified because I knew Bill from a liberal campaign where I had been head speechwriter of the Joe Duffy campaign for Senate in Connecticut. And Bill had been our third district coordinator, and I saw him as slimy and ambitious and hollow and a blowhard and didn't care for him very much.
What do you think he thought of you?
He probably didn't notice me, basically, okay. Thought that I was an arrogant, which I was. But Bill was very... Bill was a star. He was already a star. And he was somebody who came into our campaign and then came into Yale Law School and occupied that star status, as, by the way, did Hillary. And he was somebody who violated sort of an unwritten rule of Yale at the time, which is both at Yale College and Yale Law School, everybody knew that this was a little sandbox for aspiring politicians, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But, I mean, Clarence Thomas was in Bill Clinton's law school class. George W. Bush was the class ahead of me at Yale College. John Kerry was president of the political union when I started at Yale. George Pataki was chairman of the Conservative Party at Yale.
So a pretty full house. You spoke about the military earlier. We know why Bill Clinton wasn't in the military. Why weren't you in the military at that time? That was near the height of the Vietnam War.
For the same reason that probably most people in my generation weren't in the military. It didn't fit in with our plans, with our aspirations. And basically, a lot of folks before the Vietnam War started had already assumed you'd be able to avoid military service by going to college and going on to graduate school, in my case, law school. And then when they started drafting people out of graduate school, the only schools you could go to that would avoid Vietnam service were medical school and divinity school. And one of the things that people had to confront was, okay, what are we going to do about this? And there are some people who decided to go, but most of us who didn't want to go, I think as simply a matter of moral consistency, had to turn against the war. And I am convinced that most people in my generation opposed the war because we didn't want to serve. It wasn't that we didn't want to serve because we opposed the war.
How did you logistically avoid it? The draft was pretty fierce at that time.
I did. I got a teaching job. I mean, it was a teaching job 3 hours a day while I was attending my first year at law school at a Jewish parochial school. And I hadn't become religious yet, so that was a very strange sort of association.
But because it was a religious school, you were exempted or something?
All teaching positions. You could, if it was an urban school, and this certainly was, it was in a rather dicey neighborhood of New Haven, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. They assumed that if you were taking care of 7th and 8th graders and keeping them off the streets, you were essential to the national defense. And then after that, after my 1 year of teaching, they had the draft lottery, and then I had a high number. And then after that, Nixon ended the peacetime draft. And by the way, not the peacetime draft, he ended the draft for Vietnam. When Nixon ended the draft, it cut the legs out of the anti-war movement. All of a sudden, the big demonstration stopped. I was one of the coordinators of the Vietnam moratorium in October of 1969, and we had 50,000 people on the New Haven Green in New Haven, Connecticut. But after Nixon ended the draft, which he did in December of 1971, the war continued to drag on and continued to be controversial, but the demonstrations dissipated and the anti-war movement on campuses collapsed.
For all that, what did you think of John Kerry's military history and the way it played in the presidential campaign last year? He went.
He did. But one of the things that I think was insufficiently noted and is that there was a huge difference between someone like John Kerry, who graduated from Yale in 1966, and someone like George Bush, who graduated in 68. And when Kerry graduated in 66, and I remember I was there from 65 to 66. When Kerry graduated, the overwhelming student opinion, and they even took a poll for the Yale Daily News, was pro-war. Most people supported the war. And Kerry and his group in Skull and Bones, most of them went to the war. They didn't avoid the draft. By the time Bush graduated in 68, the entire campus environment across the country had turned decisively against the war, and marijuana had been introduced, which also made a huge difference.
So 2 years can make a big difference. Now, take the trajectory forward for us. You described some of the elements of your conversion experience. You didn't like working for Ron Dellums. You were set back by the war in Israel, felt you had your eyes opened. Meanwhile, a lot of your classmates from that cohort did not take your political turn, certainly not then in the 70s. How would you describe the path you went forward on? How would you describe the path that the mainstream went forward on?
Well, first of all, the path that I went forward on also related to the end of the Vietnam War. I felt tremendously guilty watching events during April, March and April of 1975, when the North Vietnamese violated the Paris Accords and the United States abandoned our allies in South Vietnam. And you had 200,000 people reportedly who died on little rickety boats trying to escape the country. And then you had the genocide in Cambodia. And I was deeply struck by the fact that my former colleagues in the anti-war movement were hugely silent about this. We had protested, talking about all the killing in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia. There was actually more killing in Southeast Asia after America left than there was during the 8 years in which we were primarily engaged in Vietnam. I thought that was deeply hypocritical. And then I had an experience in my personal life. I mean, the experience in my personal life, Irving Kristol very famously said, a neoconservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality. I wasn't mugged by reality, but I was burglarized by a real burglar. And this entire experience that happened at a time that I was working, ironically, for the San Francisco, Oakland, and Berkeley police departments absolutely persuaded me that police officers saw the world more clearly than professors.
You were working for a minority-owned ad firm, as I remember, promoting, trying to encourage minorities to get into the police force.
That's exactly right. And we were working on a federal grant, and I came in sort of with a normal 1960s kid attitude toward cops. People used to call cops pigs. Mm-hmm. I think you probably remember that.
Sure, very well.
And all of a sudden, I found that these pigs were some of the finest human beings I'd ever met. I was working primarily with African-American cops in the Oakland and San Francisco police departments, but these were just great people. And I will tell you the experience of working with them, going for a ride along overnight, and then, of course, watching them try to help me to go after this burglar who had stolen all of my stuff, this was a very powerful push to the right.
So on the political side, that was pushing you. On the personal side, you were going from secular to much more religious. And no small part of that, as I read here, when your parents stepped in and rejected a girlfriend who wasn't Jewish, who was Irish, Irish-American, said, no, no way.
Well, that's right, because it surprised me. My parents had been very involved with a very left-wing Zionist organization called Hashomer Hatzair, the Young Guard. It's sort of a Stalinist Zionist organization. When they were much younger, they met through that organization. And I assumed that my parents, who were wonderful, enlightened people, they're both scientists. My father's a physicist. My mother, may she rest in peace, was a chemist. That when I brought home my girlfriend, they'd say, oh, there's somebody you know from the Kennedy campaign, and she's so wonderful, and she's so liberal, and she's so nice. They were, but first of all, I had a very, very bad choice. You make bad choices when you're 21. And my bad choice was bringing her home for the first time for Passover. It was sort of like, guess who's coming to Seder?
Mm-hmm.
And my parents, because I'm the oldest of four boys, decided to actually make a stand on this. And it shocked me because they'd never been particularly religious. They'd been very Jewishly identified. But their stand was that it wasn't a racist stand because they were very open to the idea that Faye would convert to Judaism. She wasn't interested in that. Mm. I wasn't really interested in that because I wasn't religious.
Mm.
But the entire explosion in our family got me to take much more seriously and to begin investigating, because of the stand my parents took, the substance of a tradition that I'd always disregarded.
Instead of rebelling against it, you grasped it.
Well, originally I started by rebelling against it. I wanted to prove to my parents that, hey, you're being bad Jews by rejecting this non-Jewish girl. So I started looking in Jewish sources, because my parents and I had this intellectual – we argue in my family. That's what we do. And that's why, I mean, sort of talk radio is a natural fit for me. But I was going to argue and win the argument with my parents by actually going into authentic Jewish sources. And that was my first exposure to those sources. I mean, I'd had a bar mitzvah where I memorized a bunch of what to me at the time was gobbledygook. But when I actually started reading, started reading Ethics of the Fathers, which I talk about a little bit in my book.
And you got sucked right on in, right back in the old-time religion.
Well, not quite so quickly. It wasn't going to from hippie to chosid in 3 weeks.
Okay, not that fast.
But gradually what I found was that different aspects of Jewish practice, I began by lighting candles on Friday night. I began by putting on tefillin, phylacteries, and something that my uncle had urged me to do, my uncle Moish, who was a huge influence on me. And what happened to me is, again, it wasn't like God spoke or anything of that nature. It was just finding that every aspect of Jewish observance, particularly Sabbath observance, enriched and elevated my life, made me a happier and better person.
And brought you in. So, Michael Medved, I want to begin to get our callers in here. A lot of them are lining up to talk with you. We're talking tonight with conservative talk show host Michael Medved about what I hear him describing as the romance of the right. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Anthony's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Anthony. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, it was interesting. I had the exact opposite transformation as Mr. Medved. The first president I ever voted for was Ronald Reagan.
Okay.
I was raised in a very conservative Catholic family in Buffalo where, you know, we went to church dutifully and we, you know, respected and did not question religious and other prominent conservative political leaders. And
right.
I guess what turned me around was two things. One was in the 80s, I had a chance to meet a lot of Central Americans who were the victims of Reagan administration-supported policies there, death squads and other mm-hmm. terrorist groups that they supported. And then the other was, as I began to look at the difference between what conservatives said and how they lived their lives, I became very turned off, whether they were Democrats or Republicans. I just became very turned off to the conservative movement, and specifically I talk about you know, conservatives who are very pro-war, like Mr. Medved, but they won't go and fight the war. Or people like, you know, who espouse high morality, whether it's TV preachers like Jimmy Swaggart, you know, but then they go on and have affairs in their spare time.
So you saw moral hypocrisy there. Anthony, stick with us. Michael Medved, how do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, when I chose not to fight the war, I wasn't conservative and I wasn't pro-war. I was extremely anti-war. So I have been inconsistent over time because when I look back on the Vietnam War, I think most of the stuff that I believed when I was an anti-war activist was not true. For instance, there was a bloodbath after we left Vietnam, and I think that the left ought to own that. But concerning the moral imperfection of conservatives, he's absolutely right, of course. There are many of us on the conservative side who have loads and loads of personal problems and imperfections and difficulties just like normal human beings. The point being that it seems to me that having at least high standards for yourself that you are trying to live up to is vastly preferable to saying that nothing matters and that any kind of approaches to moral dilemmas is equally valid.
But where do you get off assigning that? I hear you assigning that again to liberals. I don't know many liberals who would embrace that view that anything goes.
Well, look, a lot of us on the right felt that some of the eagerness to forgive lawbreaking by the President of the United States was indicative of liberal priorities. And the priority was that Bill Clinton is our guy, he's in power, and he's defending Roe v. Wade, and he's defending things that we care about. Therefore, the fact that he lies under oath, in by the way, and I'm not one of these people, I do think that Bill Clinton was hounded by a determined right-wing cabal.
Around
I think that's
the impeachment,
true.
Yeah.
And I don't think that impeachment was the brightest moment in the history of the American conservative movement by any means. However, it does seem to me that you will find liberals are much more willing to not only forgive people's imperfections, which we all should be willing to do, but to suggest that it's even wrong to describe them as imperfections.
I wonder. I mean, the whole country looking at Iraq and weapons that weren't there and thinking, gosh, talk about getting off the rails. But, Anthony, you're still there. Where do you end up seeing the sort of balance of morality or moral hypocrisy today?
Well, I have to say, I don't think that Mr. Medved's being accurate in the facts. I mean, when you say high standards, what I see is that conservatives use the pretense of high standards as a way to block criticism of themselves, whether it's, you know, Strom Thurmond supporting segregation for all this time and attacking other people for being immoral. All these men in the Republican Party who support the Defense of Marriage Act while they're having affairs, like Newt Gingrich, and, you know, Dick Cheney didn't serve in the draft in Vietnam, neither did Tom DeLay, neither did all the people who are the loudest about criticizing other people for their moral hypocrisy. And it's more that aspect of it is that they're always attacking other people for their supposed immorality, and they put these standards out there. But I believe that they use it as a tool to really deflect from their own shortcomings and their own hypocrisy.
Anthony, we've got it. Michael Medved, we've got half a minute before the break here, but there's that kind of shoe on the other foot saying, what about this record? What about the conservatives? Where's the holier-than-thou come from?
Well, there shouldn't be any holier than thou. And again, I mean, there's a bumper sticker. I'm not a Christian, obviously. I'm Jewish. But there's a bumper sticker that I like that says, Christians aren't perfect, just forgiven. And it seems to me that it is vastly useful to have a band of people, in this case, the American Christian community, with which I'm very sympathetic, who are actually preaching morality. That is a good thing. And the fact that someone is imperfect or fallen or even devious and wrong in his personal life, that shouldn't excuse him, the fact that he preaches morality, but it shouldn't prevent him from doing it either.
Many ways to teach morality, I guess. We're talking tonight with conservative talk show host Michael Medved about the romance of the right. He says the right has more fun. What do you think? Are conservatives happier and nicer than liberals? Are you sad and angry to hear that or just laughing? Does Michael Medved draw you in or send you screaming from the room? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with conservative talk show host Michael Medved about the romance of the right. His new book is Right Turns, Unconventional Lessons from a Controversial Life. You can join the conversation. Here's a question I'll ask him, and I'll ask you too. What about right-wing radio? Why is it so successful? And are you a fan or foe? Why is the right on a roll? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Don's calling from Indianapolis, Indiana. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
One of my points, as I told your screener, was that we've been belonged to the Evangelical Christian Church for the last 10 years.
You've belonged to an Evangelical Christian Church?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I've always been a Democrat. I also take a little bit of exception with Mr. Medved's idea that only conservatives can have sort of this moral value. But one of the reasons that I stepped away from the Evangelical Church was that it became more and more politicized, and the fundamental idea was that you really couldn't be a Christian unless you were, one, a Republican, and two, you had this sort of blind trust in George Bush, both of which I simply couldn't sit in the pew and do.
So where does that leave you today, Don? Have you left that particular church?
Yeah, my wife and I are out searching. She is actually the more active Christian than myself, but it's been very difficult for us, actually. But the simple fact of the matter is that that view, that sort of inflexibility in their approach was just unacceptable.
Don, we've got it, and thanks for calling in from Indianapolis. Michael Medved, how about it? There's one or two maybe empty spots in the pews from an evangelical who says he doesn't want to be tied to the GOP and George Bush by his faith. You're very strong on faith, but do you necessarily tie them up to a political party?
Absolutely not. I mean, I happen to believe that it's possible to be a deeply religious person and a convicted and exemplary Christian and to still be a political liberal, just as it's possible to be a deeply committed Jew and to still be a political conservative. And that's been my more special concern. One of the chapters in my book is called Judaism is a Better Religion for Jews Than Liberalism. And you see, this works both ways. It's not just people on the right, and he's absolutely right what he said. Sometimes there are people on the right who confuse conservative politics with Christian substance. But sometimes there are people on the left, particularly in my community, who confuse Judaism and Jewish authenticity with liberalism. And despite the fact that, yep, it's true that the majority of American Jews happen to be liberal, those of us who have actually studied and taken a look at the tradition, I think we'll find at least as many conservative messages in that tradition as you would find liberal ones.
Let's get another call here. Peter's calling from New York City. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi, Howard. Thanks for taking my class.
Sure.
I mean, I'm listening to these previous callers, and I find that it just seems, and I don't even consider you conservative, but you muddy the waters when you allocate all these values to conservatives. And I find it curious that there's this strange communion of either, you know, Christian or Jewish values to the violence of force. And I don't know if you happen to see this contradiction. Yeah. The other thing, too, is
I don't at all. Let me explain to you why.
But can I just
let's hear Peter out for just a moment, Michael.
Sure.
Peter, yes.
Yeah. there's two other points you made. You said that it wasn't in your personal plans about going to Vietnam, but, you know, it was okay to allow the country to use force in Vietnam. And also, I...
Sounds like we lost Peter, but let me put the core question to you there. Peter says, how are you connecting force of violence and Christianity and Judaism? It sounds to me as though he's saying that looks like a contradiction to him.
Well, it isn't. There is virtually no pacifistic tradition within Judaism. I mean,
but Christianity? Come on.
Christianity, Jesus Christ? In Christianity, you can find some pacifistic themes, but if you take
some,
a look
I mean, that is the theme of Jesus, right?
Excuse me, Tom. I don't, it's at least not as understood by his disciples beginning within a couple of hundred years after his death. I mean, if you take a look at the history of the church, we had a little episode called the Crusades, in which was organized, run by, authorized by the church. Didn't work out very well. It involved the slaughter of lots of Jewish people
and pretty
lots
widely
of Muslims.
Seen as nothing like the emblem of the teaching of the master.
Yeah. However, you may happen to believe that you are a more authentic Christian than generations of popes, but I think that's the kind of arrogant position that, by the way,
I just read what I read. I don't know about popes. I read what I read.
All right. But the basic point that I would make about this importance of armed force is that people say that violence never solved anything. One of the questions that I ask regularly is, what solved Hitler? Hitler would be one of the biggest moral problems of our time. That was a problem that was solved ultimately and only could be solved by violence.
How do you look at Martin Luther
King? Not by psychology.
How do you look at Martin Luther King and Gandhi and that line of conflict?
I look at it very, very clearly and admiringly. Martin Luther King succeeded because he was working in the United States. Gandhi succeeded because he was working with the British Empire. A lot of people have made this point, and I think it's absolutely valid. If Gandhi had tried Gandhian tactics with Nazi Germany or with Soviet Russia, he would not have had a long career.
Let's get another call. Maureen's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Maureen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am a progressive Catholic who is raising Jewish children and married to a committed Jewish man, and I have great problems with several issues that I see as immoral with the current administration, and I'd love to hear Mr. Medved's view on that.
Okay, let's hear it.
Does he think that it's immoral for an administration to wage what was determined by certainly the Vatican and many other committed spiritual leaders as an unjust war on the claims that we, for security reasons, should not have access to all kinds of information?
You're talking about Iraq here, Maureen.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then come to find out there are no weapons of mass destruction, and the administration has never produced that evidence. Is that not a huge moral issue? Because when you are taking another's life in any religious tradition that I'm aware of, you better have very clear justification for doing that.
Michael Medved, you were with the Pope on the Crusades. You're against him on Iraq?
No. Please. I'm not. I acknowledge the Crusades ended up being full of murderous excess. I am not a supporter of the Crusades, thank you very much. And in fact, because many of the victims of the Crusades happened to be my ancestors, happened to be Jewish people.
But Maureen's pointing to she says she's a progressive Catholic. She's looking at what the Pope's saying right now. It doesn't line up with the war in Iraq, and she doesn't like the evidence that wasn't found there, and says, how do you come back and call it moral?
Well, first of all, I happen to believe you can make a case that the war is ill-advised. I happen to be a supporter of the war, but I think you can make a compelling case that the war was ill-advised and that we were ill-prepared and that sort of thing. I think that what you cannot do is to make a case that this war is uniquely immoral, especially given the idea of who we were fighting and who we are fighting, particularly right now. Because part of the basic concept that should be a clear lesson from the history of the 20th century and, frankly, all preceding centuries is that, as Vice President Cheney said when he was speaking at the commemoration of the liberation of Auschwitz just recently, evil exists. It's a reality in this world. It must be called by its name, and it must be confronted. And there are times in human history where you experience what Arthur Schlesinger has described as moral logjams, and where the only solution is going to end up being a violent solution. And whether or not Iraq falls into that category, I think you can debate. I believe that it does. But to say that this war against one of the most brutal tyrants of the latter years of the 20th century, to say that this war was immoral or that the way that it was fought was immoral is, I think, to denigrate in a very unjustifiable way the tremendous sacrifices that our military has made to spare innocent human life.
It's true, many sacrifices there, and yet kind of a different issue. We've only got a couple minutes left. Two things I want to ask you about. You say first, one is happiness and one is talk radio. First, you say conservatives are happier and nicer than liberals. What do you mean?
What I mean by that is basically contemporary liberalism has become a point of view that demands constant complaint. It demands a belief that, oh, the world is coming to an end. It's the Chicken Little school of viewing reality.
But I remember an awful lot of angry, unhappy conservatives before they got in power. You know, it's easy to be happy when you're in power. But when you're not, I remember an awful lot of fist-banging, furrowed brows, knitted brows, anger.
Oh, absolutely. And that was certainly part of what kept people away from the conservative movement. Thank God Ronald Reagan changed all of that.
Put the sunny face on.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not just putting the sunny face on. Conservatism is by its very nature an optimistic creed. And one of the things, my last chapter in the book is describing what I call do-it-yourself conservatism, which is not depending on some kind of sweeping social change, not depending on some kind of ambitious governmental program to fix your own personal problems, but to take them in hand. And frankly, that belief and that assertion that every single problem that I could face, whether it's educational or economic or whatever it happens to be, is something that I can face and overcome myself, that is empowering and that is ultimately
that
American.
You can take it in. We've got half a minute left. It's not fair. But what about the right wing and talk radio? Why so successful? The very angry voices, very cutting voices. Why so successful?
First of all, most of the voices on right-wing talk radio are not angry and cutting. They are largely optimistic. I mean, I do a radio show 3 hours every day. And I am the world's greatest optimist. I think that a lot of people who characterize right-wing radio that way.
I don't know.
Michael
Savage, Ann Coulter. It sounds pretty.
Ann Coulter doesn't have a radio show, and Michael Savage, you're right about, but he's not a real conservative.
Well, with that, we're out of time. Michael Medved, we appreciate you being with us tonight. Thanks a lot for joining us.
My great pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Michael Medved, author of Right Turns, Unconventional Lessons from a Controversial Life, host of the conservative talk radio program, The Michael Medved Show. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, a young filmmaker and his controversial new documentary about Michael Moore. This is On Point. Tonight in Orem, Utah, a documentary of political tension and controversy featuring filmmaker Michael Moore will have its big screen debut. But the film isn't made by Michael Moore. It's about Michael Moore, specifically about his visit to the Utah Valley State College campus last fall in the heat of the presidential campaign. Moore's visit generated real turmoil on the campus. Petitions circulated to rescind his invitation. Across the campus, shouting matches broke out among students. One local resident even offered $25,000 to buy every single ticket to Moore's appearance to keep others away. Brigham Young University film student Stephen Greenstreet captured the tumult surrounding Moore's visit. The result is his new documentary, This Divided State. It's a stark portrayal of the conflicting passions of red and blue voters and the difficulty of finding common ground. In this radio diary, Stephen Greenstreet recalls the day that Michael Moore controversy began.
Just 2 weeks before the presidential election, one of the most heated debates, maybe in Utah, UVSC has booked controversial filmmaker Michael Moore.
I was there basically the first day when the announcement was made that Michael Moore was coming to Utah Valley State College. I grabbed my camera and ran to campus and began rolling tape on the events unfolding.
You walk through the streets and you feel like if you like Michael Moore, you're going to hell because everybody thinks that you're a bad Mormon.
This man hates who we are, he hates our value, and he would like to destroy us.
People say that you have betrayed your religion, your country, your family.
I want you to tell me the issues, what this is really about.
You're afraid of what he said.
No, I'm not.
There were resistance for this event from all around. There was a student petition that was started by two students. walking around the school trying to collect 2,400 signatures to do two things. One, prohibit Michael Moore from coming, and then two, to recall the student body presidency that had invited Michael Moore, basically kick them out of office. And there were also community members who weren't students but were neighbors of UVSC. One man stood up in a panel discussion with a personal $25,000 check saying, I will give this to you, being the administration, if you disinvite Michael Moore. And then lawsuits were filed, and so it just began to slowly but surely get out of control.
I've heard a lot of kids say that the only reason they want this event to go through is because they don't want to lose the money. I will buy back every ticket you've sold. And I have a $25,000 cashier's check made out to UVSC right here to start it.
I could probably count on one hand how many actual civil discussions I heard. I think the documentary is an observation of how civil discourse failed miserably in this case. And I think it's a microcosm for the state of the nation as well. And I think it's very ironic that also this week that, you know, my film's premiering, we had a State of the Union. And I think my film is a State of the Union. It shows the State of the Union, which is a divided state.
This is a petition against the decision to bring Michael Moore to campus. Do you want to sign the petition?
This guy's not evil.
Personally, I hate the man.
Here, little liberal, liberal, liberals. Here, little liberals.
There were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no connection between Iraq and the attack on September 11th.
Sit down!
There is a lot of screaming in the film, a lot of name-calling, death threats being left on voicemails. Jim Bassey, the president of Student Body, in an interview says, my wife was wanting me to wear a bulletproof vest to the Michael Moore event, and he thought that she was kidding, but no, she was dead serious. She was very concerned about his safety, and he felt scared every time he went home. So the atmosphere was very vile and very threatening, especially for those, you know, supporting Michael Moore came out. They were labeled, you know, the Moore supporters, anti-American, anti-Mormon, betraying your religion, betraying your family, and things like that.
And when people stand up and say, Michael Moore is not fit to set foot on this campus, Michael Moore is not fit to open his mouth on this campus, what you're really saying is that you students who believe that Michael Moore represents you, you are not welcome here, your views are not welcome here, leave, or if you stay, shut your mouths. That's not acceptable. That's not acceptable.
There's not a conversation in the United States right now about civil discourse, and I think that this film serves as a historical study of how not to get along and how to easily put a wedge in between communities. And I'm hoping to serve this film up as a useful tool to talk and have honest conversations with those opposed to our, you know, political views, religious views, whatever, and to try to find a middle ground of at least to agree to disagree and stop the, you know, the name calling. I hope people will watch this and say, hey, that was wrong. That's not good. Let's think about this. Do we do this in our community? Do we do this in our schools? Do we do this in our churches? That's what I'm hoping the film will incite.
Stephen Greenstreet, director of the new film The Divided State. The film debuts tonight at Utah Valley State College in Orem, Utah. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.